We've all heard about how Illinois students aren't going to college in-state, but what do fall enrollment numbers look like, and are there any bright spots?
I think one of the positives is that it has gotten the attention of leaders in Springfield, and it's gotten their attention in a way that that higher ed wasn't able to do.
And when you think about concentration camps, you probably imagine atrocities from World War II. But for Illinois resident Mike Kausvik, who survived the Bosnian genocide in the 90s, the memories are much more recent.
I was 23 years old when I was taken to the camp, best time of the life. It was happy life, and it's hard to believe, really, that, being in the such a heart of the Europe that this war happened and so many people, innocent people, got killed.
Mike's story of survival and how it relates to a new exhibition at the Illinois Holocaust Museum later this hour. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, public universities were hit hard by the budget crisis that lasted more than 2 years. So are they finally bouncing back when it comes to student enrollment? We'll hear from WGLT's Ryan Denham. Plus, we pay a visit to the Illinois Holocaust Museum and a new exhibit that features objects not just from World War II, but from other genocides in modern history. It's called Stories of Survival. And as part of my visit to the museum, I spoke with a genocide survivor. That's coming up later this hour. But first, you've likely seen the headlines about how much our state has been slowly losing residents. In 2016, that number was more than 37,000, more than any other state. There's some popular explanations out there from this, everything from taxes that are too high, regulations that are too unfriendly for business, a pension system that's overrun with debt. Here's just a sample of some things you might have heard why Illinois is losing population in the past couple of years.
Last year, we lost more people than any other state in America.
Property taxes are a huge issue. Government cannot afford to continue along the same path because their residents are leaving.
Jobs are leaving Illinois, and guess what? People are following them.
That was Governor Rauner, Representative Jeannie Ives, and former State Senator Christine Redonio. And then there was Chris Kennedy, who had perhaps the most dramatic response to us when we asked him before the primary why he wanted to be governor.
I don't want to die alone. And I'm worried because the next generation of kids in Illinois are leaving the state.
But we wanted to know, when it comes to people leaving Illinois, if the numbers match all the excitement, or have we become a little too the sky is falling about this issue? The BGA, the Better Government Association, has been reporting on this. This past summer, I spoke with senior editor Bob Sector, along with Rob Peral, a fellow in the Global Cities Program of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And I started by asking Bob Sector whether politicians were right that taxes are the main reason people are leaving Illinois.
Well, part of what we've been trying to point out here is we don't really know. These are complicated issues. And the numbers that we've looked at, point to a problem, but it's not clear why the problem exists, and it's not even clear it's as extreme as it exists. What it is has become, unfortunately, is a talking point for politicians and ideological partisans to exploit, but they're cherry picking their data, and they are making it sound like the sky is falling, and that kind of obscures or takes away the room to actually take a broader look and a more closely better thought out analysis of why this problem exists,
Bob. So the taxes are kind of a shorthand. There has been maybe people leaving Illinois has become a political shorthand by politicians. What are some other popular misconceptions you think there are around this conversation?
Well, this you hear from our governor all the time that, Indiana is kicking our tails and we ought to be kicking their tails and everything's better elsewhere. And one thing that I like to contrast Scott Walker in Wisconsin with Bruce Rauner in Illinois. The governor of Wisconsin, whether he's right or wrong, is always talking up Wisconsin. And that creates an impression, probably overblown, that things are wonderful there. We have a governor here who is always bad-mouthing his own state, and that creates a different impression.
You know, it's certainly something lots of people have remarked upon. We're speaking with Bob Sector, BGA's senior editor. Rob Perel is also with us. He's a demographer with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Rob, there are probably people who are listening thinking, oh, I mentioned that number, 37,000 people in 2016. Does that really matter?
I don't think it matters in the big picture. You know, we would like to live in an area that's booming with growth. There's something about growth that a lot of us really on a psychological level take as personally affirming. Like, yeah, I live in a place that's, you know, really attracting people from all over the world or the country. But no, 37,000.
It's kind of like we're winning, right, Rob? It's sort of like, oh, we're a success. Everyone wants to be a part of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a powerful psychological feeling that we have. And then when someone takes a little bit of a decline and turns it into that negative message, like there must be something wrong with you since you're losing population, you know, that's partly what's going on here, is this kind of war of psychologies.
Okay, before we get into more of what the something wrong is, Rob, I wonder if you can give us a little context on these numbers when we're looking at
sure.
how much of the population loss, how long has this been happening, how similar are we to other states, our neighbors in the Midwest? Can you place this in context for us, please?
Yeah, thanks for asking about the big picture, because the big picture really matters. So let's start with the fact that Illinois has been losing population since the Second World War, and Chicago's population peak was 1950. And you have a similar story of Midwestern states and Midwestern cities. So we're part of what's going on, although there are other things, is that there's a national, you know, very macro level movement of population from the north and Midwest to the south and west. And you can't discount that. So that sort of, in a way, blows away some of these minor issues of what today's tax rate is or not. So that's one major thing going on. If you don't mind, a couple other things I think are really important to point out to understand the big picture in Illinois and the Midwest is let's take the state of Wisconsin as an example. It has a labor force, you know, people who are in the labor force and working, that is actually in numeric decline right now. And that's true of some other states. It's not true of Illinois. But the entire Midwest and Northeastern states are facing this declining demographics because our population, which is majority white, is really aging. It's aging, and too many of the young people, as I say, move to the South and West. These are really big factors going on.
And people are having less children, right? Particularly when we look at the white population?
On top of it, it's a bit of a perfect storm, you know? You have the aging demographics. You have these multi-decade trends. And then something that's really critical for Illinois is that we have always been a beacon for immigration. And immigration of different kinds has just been either getting cut by the government or is being blocked at the border or is slowing down for its own reasons.
And Rob, when we look at immigrants, if I remember the numbers correctly, immigrants, particularly the Latino population, have been what has accounted for the population growth in Illinois when we look at the birth rate. Is that correct?
Absolutely. If you back in the year 2000, the census found that the city of Chicago had grown for the first decade since the decade of the 1940s. And everybody was, you know, happy, happy, happy. A lot of politicians said, you know, this or that. It was all the growth was due to immigration. So immigration allowed us to make up for changes in other groups like white people leaving, et cetera. And boy, you pull out the plug of immigration, you pull that plug on Illinois, on Chicago, on other Midwestern states, and you really see the results in declining population.
That's Rob Perel. He's a demographer with the Global Cities Program of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Bob Sector's with us from the BGA, where he's a senior editor. Bob, I think the other question about this is just also as we're looking at just trying to understand the context of this. And when we have this conversation in sound bites, that makes it a little bit difficult to get at the reality as well, is that this looks very different depending on what part of Illinois you look at, right?
Yeah, I think that, and Rob might back me up on this, is that Illinois outside of the Chicago metro area, the experience is pretty much the same as the experience throughout almost all of the Midwest. They're losing population. It's dribbling away, and it's also getting older. Chicago, because Chicago is sort of the magnet of the Midwest, is a different story. But and here's something I would like to ask Rob about that I don't fully understand yet. But the census has something called hard to count census tracts. And it looks like that, you know, when you get into an urban area like Chicago, there's a concentration of hard to count numbers, and that's why these estimates, which are gyrate wildly from year to year for the Chicago area, and generally get recalculated upwards after the scary headlines have been generated by the numbers that are released. And I'm just wondering if that's our problem here, is that we live in an area with a lot of minority population where it's harder to reach people and get them to respond to the census.
Rob, is that true?
It's certainly true that folks who have lower incomes, folks who don't own their home, folks of relatively lower education, who have people in their households who don't speak English well, who are foreign-born, you know, all of those things combine to lower the average response rate, as they call it, to the census. And guess who has a lot of those folks? It's urban areas. It's places like Chicago. So that's definitely an issue. And actually, maybe we're planning on getting to this eventually, but that raises the question of what the current administration in Washington.
I was just going to ask you that, Rob, because as we're hearing so much conversation about particularly immigration questions and the census, as a demographer, as it stands right now, are you concerned about getting an accurate count of what the population is in Illinois?
So we're a heavily diverse area, a lot of immigrants in our area. Already it's a hard-to-count population. And if you wanted to, in the abstract, come up with just the best thing you could possibly do to lower the count in Chicago, if you could just really target the city of Chicago and cause it to lose population in terms of who's counted, you would do what the administration is thinking of doing, which is adding these questions about citizenship. It's kind of deadly for cities of immigrants.
Apart from these numbers and what these numbers look like, I just wanted to spend our last few minutes looking at what we know about why this is happening. And Rob or Bob, I'm not sure which one of you wants to jump in here, but when you said earlier that young people, and when we look at nationwide trends, more young people, particularly more people, are moving to the South and to the West. Rob, why is that?
There's two things that are important. One is, some of it is what we call an attitudinal change and a lifestyle change. The South and the West became livable with the invention of air conditioning after the Second World War. And we all know folks who just simply want to be near mountains and seashore, et cetera. And you can do that now in a way that you couldn't do that in the past. So there have been these social, you know, what do we celebrate in Hollywood and movies and television shows?
Sunshine.
We celebrate people being
and warm weather,
sunshine.
Right, yeah.
So no doubt about it. And there's one other thing. I don't want to turn off track too much, but there's something else I want to make sure we address in our conversation today, which is that there's one group that explains everything. Everything we've been saying about population loss would just be not an issue. We wouldn't even be talking here except for one single population, which is that the city of Chicago and Cook County and Illinois are having a reverse great migration of African Americans. It's African American population loss explains all of the flat and slow growth, much more than any other group, even with the declining immigrants, et cetera. And that's a topic that needs to be looked at, is what is causing African Americans to leave the state in the numbers they are, much more than any other population.
And a reverse great migration, in other words, going back to the South, which is what we saw before World War II, from the turn of the previous century up until the 30s and 40s, a tremendous influx from the South to the Midwest, which you're now saying is reversed. Bob, as we're wrapping up here, I just want to ask you how you think, as you've talked a lot about the headlines and the misconceptions, how should we be thinking about this issue, knowing that it's a complex one?
Well, the one thing you should do, and I think Rob touched on this, you shouldn't get hung up on these year-by-year estimates, which gyrate wildly and are subject to significant revisions, because that creates a misleading impression. You also need to dispense with, or you need to consider the source when you hear people exploiting this, be that politicians or some advocacy groups that are trying to exploit it. And then the bigger picture is you would want to convene a lot of stakeholders here, from the right to the left, the business community, labor, to actually talk about these things and try to come up with some concrete understanding of what's happening, why it's happening, and how we can deal with it, given the resources we have and the needs we have. And if you do that, you're not going to solve the problem necessarily, but you're going to understand it better, and you're going to mitigate some of the harm that's being done by people who are trying to exploit issues they don't fully understand.
Certainly a good thing to remember as the rhetoric will continue to heat up during this campaign season. I want to thank Bob Sector with the Better Government Association, a senior editor, and Rob Perrell, a demographer who's also a fellow in the Global Cities Program of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Nice to be here.
Support for the 21st comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting the experimental films of Rene Baker on Saturday, September 22nd at 2 p.m. at the Pennsylvania Avenue Residence Hall. Baker will present her films and discuss the creative process in producing these works. More at cas.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Over the past several years, most public universities across Illinois have seen a decline in enrollment. According to the state's Board of Higher Education, Illinois is the number two exporter of college students, behind just New Jersey. The numbers this fall are more encouraging, at least for two universities, U of I, our biggest campus, and Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. Reporter Ryan Denham has been reporting on this issue. He's the digital content director at one of our partner stations, WGLT in Bloomington Normal, and he joins us on the line now to talk about winners and losers in higher education enrollment. Hi, Ryan. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Sure thing.
I feel like we've heard so much in recent years, not just in the news, but from politicians, about how more and more high school graduates are going out of state for college. This has been kind of a talking point in the election. How bad is it?
It's pretty bad. We don't currently have the fall 2018 numbers for how many students are leaving the state, but in interviewing Al Bowman from the Illinois Board of Higher Education the other day, he said this year is going to be pretty similar to last year, which was not great. I think the most interesting way to kind of phrase this is from 2002 to 2016, we saw a 57% increase in the rate of out-of-state enrollment for our high school students. So to put that another way, that's like the size of an entire Northern Illinois University or Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville campus. So think of it as those students are missing, and it's the size of an entire campus.
And so those seem like big numbers. Ryan, why do you think this is something that lawmakers like to talk about, other than being obviously a point of pride?
I think Al Bowman, when I interviewed Al Bowman, he's the executive director of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, he put it in sort of an interesting way. He said this out-migration problem that the state is sort of infatuated with is actually sort of a double-edged sword. Here's how he put it.
I think one of the positives is that it has gotten the attention of leaders in Springfield. And it's gotten their attention in a way that higher ed wasn't able to do. It's sort of obvious, tangible evidence that there are some significant challenges facing higher ed, and if we don't address them as a state, we will suffer the consequences.
That's the Illinois Board of Higher Education Executive Director Al Bowman speaking to WGLT's Ryan Denham, who's on the line now from WGLT in Bloomington Normal. Ryan, so serious consequences. When Al Bowman's talking about challenges, what in particular, what kind of solutions are they working on to address these challenges?
Well, in recent months, the Higher Education Working Group, which is a bipartisan group of lawmakers, they put forth several bills that actually won passage in the past year here. So that is, there's a new merit-based scholarship program with $25 million plus a university match. So that's sort of a new thing. A lot of the state aid that's been out there has been need-based, so this is merit-based aid aimed at trying to keep students from leaving the state. Lawmakers also approved some legislation that'll provide more year-to-year stability for that need-based program, which is called the MAP grants or monetary award programs. Those are two pretty tangible things that lawmakers addressed in this past session that higher education officials are pretty hopeful will actually have a positive impact.
And then when we think about things that specific campuses are doing, when you talk about different programs, the University of Illinois recently announced some new programs, particularly for in-state students. How are U of I's enrollment numbers looking like?
Things at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the Chicago campus were pretty good. Freshman numbers were up. Total enrollment was up in both campuses, so things are pretty good there. Things were also pretty good at campuses like Illinois State University, had a pretty large freshman class, even if total enrollment was pretty flat. In terms of good news, I think Eastern Illinois University would probably be the kind of the outlier in this pack. Eastern has had a pretty tough go of it as of late, so they've had layoffs and furloughs during the impasse. But they've been bragging a bit this time around. They launched seven new majors. They outsourced some marketing and recruitment to an outside firm that rebranded the whole thing, created a scholarship program for students from that area in Charleston, and actually had pretty good success. Their freshman class has grown by about 24%, and their overall enrollment is up 7%.
So those are the campuses that are doing well. When we're thinking about the budget impasse, you referenced that with Eastern Illinois universities. The places that were hit particularly hard, are those the campuses that have had the sharpest declines in enrollment?
So the regional universities like Eastern and Western, they had been hit very hard. Western Illinois, you know, they had just in June, their university announced 24 additional faculty layoffs, 62 teaching positions that were going to be unfilled. And now you're getting a sense of maybe why they made that decision. Their total enrollment this fall is down 10% at Western, and their freshman class is down 22%. If you think of the trajectory of your average student, if your freshman class is down 22%, that hurts you year after year after year after year. That just will just shrink from attrition and retention numbers. So by the time they're seniors, that's an even smaller class. Mm-hmm. Chicago State is another hard-hit campus from the budget impasse. Their enrollment is down 5% again this fall, and they've lost half of their student body since 2013.
And then when we're thinking about enrollment, I wonder how much international student enrollment makes a difference here.
Yeah, it's international recruitment is sort of an interesting beast. It varies on campus to campus. University of Illinois is sort of famous for international recruitment, but their international recruitment is sort of plateaued here. They had their freshman class this year actually saw a decline in international students for the first time in years, as they're sort of going after in-state students for several reasons. At Illinois State University here, where I am, sort of going in the other direction. They've just hired a company basically outsourcing their international recruitment. They picked up 65 new international students through this program, and they're going the other direction. So, you know, I think coloring all of this is the Trump administration's immigration policies. When you talk to higher education folks, they say that, you know, the rhetoric coming out of Washington has certainly made it difficult to recruit international students, and they're wondering, you know, how much longer that'll last.
I know that, Ryan, you spoke with Al Bowman. He's the executive director of the Illinois Board of Higher Education. In terms of thinking about solutions for all of this, what more did he have to say about that?
So the next kind of step in this is the funding formula. So if you remember last year, lawmakers in Springfield, they approved a funding formula rewrite for K through 12 schools, a major shakeup to how money flows from the state to local schools. Now higher education is going to be next in that line to get a similar treatment. And so Al Bowman and his staff at the Illinois Board of Higher Education is working with this bipartisan group of lawmakers on a similar funding formula rewrite. They hope to have something, some kind of version of it sketched out by April 1st.
That's WGLT's Ryan Denham from the campus of ISU speaking to us about higher ed enrollment. Ryan, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Skokie has a new exhibit called Stories of Survival. It features photographs of objects with special meaning to people who were imprisoned, not just in Nazi concentration camps, but other genocides throughout the 20th and 21st century. These are personal items, often mundane, clothes, toys, notes, and more, but each tell an important story. How do you remember the past? How do you overcome it? And how do you move forward? I thought about those questions during a recent visit to the museum, which is just northwest of Chicago. I was led on tour by the chief curator, Ariel Weininger. And later, you'll hear my conversation with one of the exhibit participants, Mike Kausvik, a survivor of the Bosnia-Herzegovina genocide.
My name is Ariel Weininger. I'm the chief curator of collections and exhibitions at the Illinois Holocaust Museum.
And can you tell us about Stories of Survival?
Sure. There are items in the exhibition from Bosnia, Sudan, Rwanda, Cambodia, Armenia, and Iraq and Syria, again, are represented in the exhibition.
All of which are modern day, I think, genocides. I think we tend to think about how far removed the Holocaust is, but I wonder how much of this exhibit is also reminding people that this continues to happen?
Yes. And Armenia, you know, preceded the Holocaust. So, yes, I mean, the promise of never again, we see, has not been fulfilled. And these things continue to happen, unfortunately, up until very current issues.
So I wonder if you can take us through some of the objects and some of the photographs. There's everything from tea sets to typewriters to dominoes.
Yes, these are everyday items. These are items from toys, jewelry, clothing. And what happens is with the history that they are, the stories that are revealed in the photographs by the survivors or their loved ones, we realize that these items become the most important items within a family, within generations. Some of the stories that you learn about here are very complete. They start from where the family started out, when someone was born, all the way through their experience of coming to the United States. In other cases, the survivor associated to the object is now deceased, and the descendant knows very little about the object. And that actually is also a common theme, is that in such situations of trauma,
people don't want to share why they kept this object.
So certain survivors, I think as part of dealing with that history, we'll talk a lot about it, and you'll see that reflected in the photographs, and others are very, very private.
Mm. You have two airplane ticket stubs here.
Yes, those come from a Yazidi refugee to this country. He basically explained in his photograph, in the writing of it, which is in Arabic and translated in the gallery, that the two things that he carries with him since he got on that plane are the boarding pass stubs, the ticket stubs. And
He got on a plane to come to America.
Since he got on a plane to come to America. He came from out of Iraq he was in Jordan, and from Jordan to the United States. And it just so happens, you can see on the ticket stub, that the date that his flight was coming to America was July 4th. For the exhibition, we also asked the survivors to give us a small photograph of themselves to give another layer of information to the visitor so that they could see the object that came with the person, hear a personal story about it, but then also see who that survivor was. And it was very exciting for us when we got the picture from Kasim, that it's him in a cap and gown because he came to this country only looking for and wanting a better life, and then was accepted to the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and
graduated a few months ago.
Yeah, just graduated a few months ago, and you see him in his cap and gown.
So the photographs surround the objects, which are then in the center of this exhibit. And almost in the center, there's this with these clothes. Children's clothes.
Yes, there are three pieces of children's clothes. It's actually two outfits. One is a dress, and one is another dress that was matched with a cardigan. And these belong to two young girls who were killed in the Rwandan genocide. Their mother, a survivor of the genocide, gave them to us to be on loan during the exhibition. Even though the genocide was in 1994, as she explains in the photographs, she only came upon owning these objects again in 2017. The mother's name, the survivor's name, is Immaculée. And Immaculée had found out that there were going to be roadworks in the area of Rwanda near where her girls were murdered. And so she went back to Rwanda, and they did do a, they looked for and then found a mass grave. And the way in which she identified her daughter's bodies was by these two outfits that she was wearing, or that they were wearing. And you'll see the objects are incredibly heartbreaking and moving to see.
Right, this is maybe a four-year-old's dress?
One girl was three and the other was five. And also her husband was killed at that point in time. You'll see that the what's also incredible as part of this project is Immaculée decorated the photographs not only with the stories of her daughters, but she put stickers of flowers and little firecrackers, fireworks on the pictures. And I think that she was showing the love she feels for her daughters, but also to bring a certain amount of sweetness of the life that they had to the photographs. And there's a fourth photograph, an object that's included, which is a family album. And in it, you see photographs of the family prior to the genocide. And the text that she has written around it is really a love letter to her husband, who was killed in the genocide. It was very intentional that we set these objects at this point, at the sort of center point of the exhibition. Something that I sort of had thought about while we were putting up the exhibition. There are the reasons the walls are framed in the way they are is it was based on the markings that you see inside of a camera. So you would have these sort of layers upon layers, and what comes into focus and is what's in the center. But in the way in which we had to install the exhibition, they become these circles that you kind of have to keep walking around and around. And as we brought objects into the gallery and the photographs, they became these barriers where you had to keep kind of going out and making circles. And I started thinking about walking in circles, and I kind of got a little too involved in thinking about circumambulation, which is something that a lot of religions do. You walk around as part of religious practice, and the most common thing that I think comes to mind is the Hajj at the Kaaba in Mecca, when Muslims go around the Kaaba. And so I looked further and further into it, and it really does end up that circumambulation is something that every religion does. And what's always at the core of whatever it is that you're circulating around is the sacred. And again, as I mentioned, I think that what ended up happening is really these everyday objects kind of turned into sacred objects by being in this exhibition, by having their loved ones tell the stories of the objects.
That's Arielle Weininger, the chief curator of the new exhibit at the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. It's called Stories of Survival, and it will be up through the year. When we come back, you'll hear my conversation with one of the exhibit participants, a genocide survivor who donated his own objects to the museum and shares his story of survival. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you've been hearing conversations from my recent visit to the Illinois Holocaust Museum's new exhibit. It's called Stories of Survival. While there, I was able to sit down with one of the 60 participants in the exhibit, Mike Kausvik. He was imprisoned twice in concentration camps during the genocide in Bosnia. And the items you'll hear Mike talk about are a set of playing cards he made by hand using old cookie boxes that had been donated by the Red Cross. He also wrote recipes on cigarette wrappers because while he didn't smoke, he was very hungry, and he remembered hearing that victims of the Nazi Holocaust used recipes and wrote them down as a way to remember food and life outside the camps. This was back in 1992. Today, Mike lives in Skokie with his family, and I began by asking him about those objects that, as Ariel Weininger said, went from the everyday to sacred.
I spent over 5 months in Bosnia. Some prisoners, I don't know if I could call them prisoners, we were brought from our homes in the camp, but they came with the idea to write the recipes, thinking that's going to keep our mind focused on, you know, on survival, and because we were so hungry and starving, and I guess somebody also mentioned that Jewish people did this in Auschwitz. So somebody who was reading the history knew about this, and then we decided to start writing recipes, and we got cigarettes every 2 weeks from Red Cross, and we used that paper from cigarette boxes to write the recipes. Some guards also were creative, and especially those that used to cook, you know, they had some tools, and they... from the boxes that we received from the Red Cross for the cookies, every 2 weeks we received a box of cookies, half a pound. They cut those boxes and made the playing cards, and we play the cards. Obviously, we had to hide this from the guards, but that was one way of survival. I mean, this is a very long story to explain, you know, what really happened at camp, but this happened maybe after 4 months being in the camp. In the beginning, we were... you know, a lot of people got killed and starved to death. And after the Red Cross discovered us, we kind of were safe, and we were, had more freedom to, walk around the camp.
Mm. How old were you when you first went? Were taken? How old were you when you were first taken to?
I was 23 years old when I was taken to the camp. Time of the life. First camp was called Omarska, very, very brutal camp. That's the most killings happened in that camp. There were probably around 3,000 people went through that camp. And then after the International Red Cross and some journalists actually discovered this camp, they moved us to a mountain, which was a military barns, you know, and like I guess military space that where they actually personally before the war had exercises for the Yugoslavian army. But in that camp, probably was more than, I would say, around 4,000 from different cities. And then I stayed in that camp till December 18th, 1992, when I was freed. With help of UN and the Red Cross.
Mm. What was your life like before you were in the camps?
Our life in Bosnia was just like, you know, everybody's life, normal life, you know, happy life. We had a good life, you know.
Like a 22-year-old guy.
Yeah, exactly. That was, you know, the best time of my life. It was supposed to happen at that time because I finished school. I finished the army. We had, In Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, it was mandatory to serve the army for 1 year. After that, you have your life, you know, you look for the girlfriends, you enjoy the life, and, you know, it was a happy life. We all had a good life, and it's hard to believe, really, that, being in the such a heart of the Europe that this war happened and so many people, innocent people, got killed. If any government wanted to stop this war, they could have stopped that at the right time and free these people and stop that war. But because of the politics, because of the, you know, different ideas to create different borders or something, they let the war going on for 5 years, and over 200,000 people got killed, innocent. And one of them is my brother, who is missing, still missing. You know, we never found his remains. And actually, I didn't mention I lost two brothers in the war.
Lost two brothers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if somebody acted sooner, you know, to stop this war, I wouldn't be here. You know, that many, because I knew that it could be stopped if they wanted to stop.
Hmm.
You know what happened at camp? How many times I was beaten up? How many times I saw a person killed in front of my eyes, how many times I saw, you know, people died because they were beaten up to death. They pass out in our arms. You know, that happened in that camp. You know, there was a room like this. That's why I wrote the book, Death in the White House. There was a small room like this, over 200 people sitting on top of each other. You know, it's a small room with one window, 150 degrees in there. It was summer day, you know, and no air to breathe. People, you know, passed out, screaming. Every day, guards come and grab 10, 15 people in front of the door and beat them up. Some of them survive, some of them don't. They leave those dead people in pile, and then next day, or next night, actually, they come pick them up. They take them away. They do this all over every day. And in 2013, in Prijedor, where I'm from, there was discovered mass grave over 1,000 people. And all of this, most of these people in that mass grave came from these camps.
The camps you were in.
Right. So that's the biggest mass grave discovered in Europe after World War II in my city. Unfortunately, my city, where I'm from, they're the most war criminals prosecuted, and you know, the most concentration camp in Bosnia. So it was really bad what I went through. But again, to tell the story of survival, it's not easy to talk about that, and it's talking these stories of every day, or I kind of listen to myself and think people don't believe this really happened. You know, sometimes I don't believe this really happened.
Mm. You were talking about survival before, for when you were there in the camps. The playing cards, the recipes, you said you shared stories with other people. When you left the camps, you chose to take those with you?
Yeah, I guess, you know, when they discovered that they will release us, they told us to pack our stuff. I mean, we didn't have much. We had, you know...
What did you have?
I had...
maybe some clothes?
Some clothes, actually. In International Red Cross brought us jackets and shoes before we were get ready to go, because it was in the mountain, very wintry and cold. So they had to, you know, clothe us and provide uniforms. So that's what we actually, many guards actually sold that for cigarettes, because there was a money, a buying power, buying food, buying salt, buying apple for cigarettes. And they sold their shoes, they sold their uniforms. But I actually kept my jacket, and I kept these playing cards and recipes. And if you ask me this question, I really don't, it's kind of sad, but I don't remember half of this stuff when we got news that we will be released. You know, it's hard to explain that joy. And it's hard. It's just, you know, we did all these things on the go, on the fly, you know. So I didn't even remember I grabbed this stuff, but later on turns out to be very valuable item. And you know, fortunately, when I was released that day, like I said, it was so much joy and people screaming happiness.
And I'm sure you just wanted to get out of there, yeah, as fast
and,
as you could.
So when we got to Croatia, you know, I my parents were there, and they told me, you know, I got the shocking news. My brother was killed. I didn't know. So that's another part of my life. You know, you are freedom and happiness, and boom, you got the bad news, and then all that was gone for me. And I don't remember, like I said, but for 3-4 days I was sitting in the corner of one room and not talking to anybody. When I was after, that was after release. So when I was in kind of shock because of losing the brother, and with help of doctors and my family, I kind of got back, you know. But I've been through a lot of shocks in my life. It's very interesting. Another one, when we came here in 1993 in July, 2 days after, you know, we arrived here, my sister from Croatia called me and told me my second brother was killed. And I couldn't tell that to my parents for 1 year. I was hiding that from them. And, you know, it was very difficult for me again to hide that, because they were asking if he's hungry, if he's cold, why is he not calling? You know, I was trying to tell them there is a war, you know, phone lines are cut and there's no communication between the cities. But later on, my aunt called from England and told them the story. So there was kind of a little relief from me. But again, you could see all these shocks, even just arriving to the United States, you know, different culture, different language. I didn't speak any English. It was another shock for me. But I went through all of this and became a stronger person. Now I'm talking and trying to make this young generation understand that their job is to raise their voice and stop this sooner if it happens somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about that, the whole idea of sharing this story. And do you worry now when you look at things that are happening all over the world that there are places that you're worried that this might be happening again?
Well, absolutely. That's what bothers me the most. And that's happening, you know. Happening. It happened in Syria, it happening in Rwanda, it happening now at Memoria, but people are too slow to act, you know, and that's what bothers me the most. We said after World War II, never again, you know, to what happened in Jewish people, but happened again to Bosnia and Somalia, like I said. And that's what, like I said, bothers me the most. That's happening now in 21st century.
When you look back on the playing cards and the recipes, what does it make you think of?
Well, you know, that everything that we think about and when we go back and visit this camp now brings us back into the bad memories. But these playing cards and cigarettes, actually, I would say definitely cigarettes were our lifesaver, you know. For cigarettes, even people who didn't smoke, they had to smoke a little bit to kind of ease the tensions, but there was a gold for us. We were buying food, and that's a survival item. So this playing cards and the recipes are, even though they bring us back to bad memories, they still kind of has, they have some kind of meaning. They have inspiration or of survival or some message that, you know, hopefully when people read this, you know, hopefully even this could be message to somebody that if there is such a thing happening again somewhere to raise the voice.
I was wondering if it was a little like what you said about how when you found out that you were going to be released, sort of how you can have this joy, but then also know that there's a lot of sorrow sometimes at the same time. Is that how you feel when you look at these objects, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you feel joy and you feel sorrow at the same time. But it just, I was in Croatia 2 weeks ago, and I went to the store and to look for this pack of cigarettes. It's called Filter 160. They still make them. And I had a whole pack smoking 1 week, even though I don't smoke. But, you know, it's not fun to, you know, go back and relive that again. But having that cigarette and kind of feeling that experience again with that cigarette brings the memories back. But it's actually, this time it was joy, you know, like I survived. And
you survived. You've been living in the U.S. for,
right,
you're married, you have children now.
Yeah, I live here almost 25 years. I came here in 1993, and I have a wife and two kids, beautiful kids, and 11 years old and 16 years old, and living American dream. Yeah.
That's Mike Kosvick, a Skokie resident and participant in the Illinois Holocaust Museum's new exhibit, Stories of Survival. We'll tweet out a link to his book, Death in the White House, and have more information on the Illinois Holocaust Museum at our website, 21stshow.org. That does it for us today. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps and always find past shows that way. As I said, our website is a great resource, 21stshow.org. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, you just have to remember our website. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.